So here we are again, and another Richard Rudin podcast, and this wasn't my intended topic as such, although there are elements that I was going to include, but it has been inspired as this, and my topic has changed by outrage at the total wall-to-wall coverage and hagiography of the late Pope, Pope Francis. And it was impossible to find any other news yesterday, Monday, the bank holiday Monday. And I would just like to remind news editors and editors everywhere that this is, first of all, a Protestant country. And I don't want to sound like a bigot, but it is a fact. And that Catholics are a minority, a very small minority of religious belief. And only about 10%, according to the latest figures, of the country identify themselves as Catholics. And of those, probably very few indeed, believe that the Pope has been appointed by God through the conclave of the cardinals and all the rest of it, and let alone all the tenets of supernatural belief. But they go to Catholic Church occasionally and they say they're a Catholic, but even so, it's only a small minority of the population. And 25% of us profess no religious belief whatsoever. Now, this has been an important factor in my upbringing, in as much as there was no religion there. I wasn't christened or baptised. My parents were both atheists or agnostics at best. And my grandfather on my mum's side, my mum's father, and her relatives were very anti-religious and atheistic. And my grandfather became a socialist and an atheist. He became an atheist after the First World War, when his beloved brother was killed in action towards the end of the Great War, and he became a socialist at the end of the Second World War. He'd been a liberal like his father had been. I'm going to read a couple of very short extracts from my grandfather's biography in this, but I'm going to concentrate to back up my non-religious beliefs and advocate the field of science and rationalism through several readings and clips. I've got Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion, one of the best-known atheistic books and arguments against religion of all kinds, not just Catholicism, but probably especially Catholicism. And then we have A Bit of Fun from Monty Python as well, and that song. But let's set out the stall, first of all, by going to one of the greatest advocates of atheism, and that's Christopher Hitchens. And this is from a piece on YouTube that I found. It's called The Best of Christopher Hitchens' Religion, A Document of Reason. So this is Christopher Hitchens, and this was posted about a year ago, as I record this, in April. You know, I'm not quite sure when the bits were actually recorded. There are various bits of him with full head of hair and then lacking hair due to his cancer treatment, I presume.
The Catholic Church, said Newman, holds it better for the sun and moon to drop from heaven, for the earth to fail, and for all the many millions on it to die in extremest agony than that one soul, I will not say will be lost, but should commit one venial sin, should tell one willful untruth, or should steal one farthing without excuse. You'll have to say it's beautifully phrased, ladies and gentlemen, but to me, and here's my proposition, what we have here, and picked from no mean source, is a distillation of precisely what is twisted and immoral in the faith mentality. Its essential fanaticism, its consideration of the human being as raw material, and its fantasy of purity. Once you assume a creator and a plan, it makes us objects in a cruel experiment whereby we are created sick and commanded to be well. I'll repeat that. Created sick and then ordered to be well. And over us to supervise this is installed a celestial dictatorship, a kind of divine North Korea. Greedy, exigent, I would say more than exigent, greedy for uncritical praise from dawn till dusk, and swift to punish the original sins with which it so tenderly gifted us in the very first place. However, let no one say there's no cure. Salvation is offered. Redemption, indeed, is promised at the low price of the surrender of your critical faculties. Religion, it might be said, must be said, would have to admit, makes extraordinary claims, but though I would maintain that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, rather daringly provides not even ordinary evidence for its extraordinary supernatural claims. Therefore, we might begin by asking, and I'm asking my opponent as well as you, is it good for the world to appeal to our credulity and not to our skepticism? Is it good for the world to worship a deity that takes sides in wars and human affairs? To appeal to our fear and to our guilt, is it good for the world? To our terror of death, is it good to appeal? To preach guilt and shame about the sexual act and the sexual relationship, is this good? To terrify children with the image of hell and eternal punishment, not just of themselves, but of their parents and those they love. Perhaps worst of all, to consider women an inferior creation, is that good for the world? And can you name me a religion that has not done that? There is actually only one cure for poverty, as it happens, and everybody knows it, and it's well understood, and it's perfectly simple. It's called the empowerment of women. If you give women control, if you will allow women control over the number of times they have babies, I'll just put it as family style as that, if you'll give them that, and maybe throw in a handful of seeds and a bit of credit, if you do that, the floor of the whole society will rise, everything, the whole floor of development will rise. That's the proposition Mother Teresa dedicated her life to opposing. Name me a monotheistic religion that dedicates itself to the empowerment of women. Religion forces nice people to do unkind things, and also makes intelligent people say stupid things. Handed a small baby for the first time, is it your first reaction to think, beautiful, almost perfect, now please hand me the sharp stone for its genitalia that I may do the work of the Lord? No. It is, as the great physicist Steven Weinberg has very aptly put it, in the ordinary moral universe, the good will do the best they can, the worst will do the worst they can, but if you want to make good people do wicked things, you'll need religion. Everyone in the civilized world has roughly agreed, including the majority of Arabs and Jews and the international community, that there should be enough room for two states for two peoples in the same land. I think we have a rough agreement on that. Why can't we get it? The UN can't get it. The US can't get it. The Quartet can't get it. The PLO can't get it. The Israeli parliament can't get it. Why can't they get it? Because the parties of God have a veto on it, and everybody knows that this is true. Because of the divine promises made about this territory, there will never be peace. There will never be compromise. There will instead be misery, shame, and tyranny, and people will kill each other's children for ancient books and caves and relics. And who is going to say that this is good for the world? Do you wish it to be true that there is someone who has you under permanent round-the-clock supervision and surveillance, who knows what you think even when you are asleep, who can convict you, I borrow again from the Big Brother analogy, of thought crime, and who can condemn you forever to eternal penalty and torture if you make the smallest mistake, who creates you sick, who makes you a sinner, who says you are originally wicked, and then orders you to be well and to recover on penalty of torture? What is this but the most horrific sadomasochistic prostration of the human personality before the most interstellar coldness of authority and tyranny? Why does anyone wish this was true? To emancipate oneself from this, it seems to me, is the beginning of the long story of human liberation. And from very early days, from Democritus, from Lucretius, from Epicurus, all the way through to Spinoza, to Einstein, to our own day, that's been the real struggle. The right to look the churches and the priests and the godheads in the eye and say, I don't believe it. I don't believe a word of it, and you can't make me. It's the beginning of civilization, as well as the beginning of liberation.
Well, that was Christopher Hitchens, and we'll have Richard Dawkins up and coming. But before we go any further, there's just a couple of short extracts from my maternal grandfather's biography. I should also explain before I go any further that the atheism in my family comes from both sides, in that my paternal grandfather was also a committed atheist. So I didn't stand a chance of being a Christian or anything else. This is a very short extract from a book about my grandfather, Edwin Swale. The book is called Camel Combat Ace, The Great War Flying Career of Edwin Swale. It's by Barry Marsden and is available from all the normal retail outlets. You'll also find a Wikipedia page if you key in your search box, Edwin Swale, S-W-A-L-E, Edwin Swale. This is from chapter one. It's called Boyhood and Biplanes. And it's relevant because it talks about the atheism of my great, great, great grandfather. I think that's enough greats. Edwin Swale was a Victorian, born in Chesterfield in the June of the last year of the 19th century. His father, Arthur Whiteley Swale, listed as a tailor cutter in the 1901 census, came from Keighley in the Airedale-Wharfedale area of Yorkshire. In 1870, during a time of local depression in the woolen trade, Edwin's grandfather Seth, crazy name, crazy guy, brought his family to the North Derbyshire town where Arthur met and married a local girl, Emmeline Furness. Seth had opened a shop on Sheffield Road, supplying clothes to people in the outlying mining villages of East Derbyshire. His three boys took the goods and samples by train, and the buyers paid for them in weekly instalments. Arthur was somewhat of an entrepreneur, who in time decided he would rather work for himself than for his parents, and he was granted a mortgage from the Yorkshire Penny Bank to buy a property on Vicar Lane near the town centre. He also yearned for respectability, according to a family member, perhaps concerned that his father, Seth, was an unusual personality for the time, as a committed atheist and socialist, described later by Edwin as a Marxist atheist. He was perhaps not the ideal model for someone who wished to abide by the social mores of the day. So we can see in the family there, going back all those generations to the early to mid-Victorian period. Interestingly enough and scarily enough, there's a picture, a family picture taken, I think in 1959, I was about 2 years old, of the four generations of the family, including Arthur, my great-grandfather. And it's interesting to think that I've been held by a man who was born in the 1870s. That makes me feel really old. But anyway, the roots of my atheism and scepticism come from there. My grandfather's atheism became an issue for him when he was in public life, serving as, amongst many things, on Chesterfield Borough Council. In 1953, this is back to the book now, in 1953, he was elected mayor of Chesterfield after standing to oppose someone parachuted in by a pressure group to take up the position. Swale had never agreed with the principle that length of service on the council should itself imply a right to become mayor, and had therefore allowed his own name to be put forward in contention. His action led to his religious beliefs being challenged when a non-conformist minister found out about his atheism and declared he was not a fit person to be made mayor in view of his non-religious convictions. Swale retorted that as mayor he would put aside all political and religious affiliations during the period of his mayoralty, and any further protests quickly fizzled out. And quite right too. This is from Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion, 10th Anniversary Edition. Human thoughts and emotions emerge from exceedingly complex interconnections of physical entities within the brain. An atheist, in this sense a philosophical naturalist, is somebody who believes there is nothing beyond the natural physical world. No supernatural creative intelligence lurking behind the observable universe. No soul that outlasts the body, and no miracles, except in the sense of natural phenomena that we don't yet understand. If there is something that appears to lie beyond the natural world, as it is now imperfectly understood, we hope eventually to understand it and embrace it within the natural. As ever, when we unweave a rainbow, it will not become less wonderful. Great scientists of our time, who sound religious, usually turn out not to be so when you examine their beliefs more deeply. This is certainly true of Einstein and Hawking. The present Astronomer Royal and President of the Royal Society, Martin Rees, told me that he goes to church as an unbelieving Anglican out of loyalty to the tribe. He has no theistic beliefs, but shares the poetic naturalism that the cosmos provokes in the other scientists I've mentioned. In the course of a recently televised conversation, I challenged my friend, the obstetrician Robert Winston, a respected pillar of British Jewry, to admit that his Judaism was of exactly this character, that he didn't really believe in anything supernatural. He came close to admitting it, but shied at the last fence. To be fair, he was supposed to be interviewing me, not the other way round. When I pressed him, he said he found that Judaism provided a good discipline to help him structure his life and lead a good one. Perhaps it does, but that, of course, is not the smallest bearing on the truth value of any of its supernatural claims. There are many intellectual atheists who proudly call themselves Jews and observe Jewish rites, perhaps out of loyalty to an ancient tradition or to murdered relatives, which many of us share with its most distinguished exponent, Albert Einstein. They may not believe, but to borrow a phrase from the philosopher Daniel Dennett, they believe in belief. One of Einstein's most eagerly quoted remarks is, "Science without religion is lame, religion without science is blind." But Einstein also said, "It was, of course, a lie what you read about my religious convictions, a lie which is being systematically repeated. I do not believe in a personal God, and I have never denied this, but have expressed it clearly. If something is in me which can be called religious, then it is the unbounded admiration for the structure of the world, so far as our science can reveal it." Does it seem that Einstein contradicted himself, that his words can be cherry-picked for quotes to support both sides of an argument? No. By religion, Einstein meant something entirely different from what is conventionally meant. As I continue to clarify the distinction between supernatural religion on the one hand and Einsteinian religion on the other, bear in mind that I'm calling only supernatural gods delusional. Here are some more quotations from Einstein to give a flavour of Einsteinian religion. "I am a deeply religious non-believer. This is a somewhat new kind of religion. I have never imputed to nature a purpose or a goal or anything that could be understood as anthropomorphic. What I see in nature is a magnificent structure that we can comprehend only very imperfectly, and that must fill a thinking person with a feeling of humility. This is a genuinely religious feeling that has nothing to do with mysticism. The idea of a personal God is quite alien to me and seems even naive." In greater numbers since his death, religious apologists understandably try to claim Einstein as one of their own. Some of his religious contemporaries saw him very differently. In 1940, Einstein wrote a famous paper justifying his statement, "I do not believe in a personal God." This and similar statements provoked a storm of letters from the religiously orthodox, many of them alluding to Einstein's Jewish origins. The extracts that follow are taken from Max Jammer's book, Einstein and Religion, which is also my main source of quotations from Einstein himself on religious matters. The Roman Catholic Bishop of Kansas City said, "It is sad to see a man who comes from the race of the Old Testament and its teaching deny the great tradition of that race." Other Catholic clergymen chimed in, "There is no other God but a personal God. Einstein does not know what he's talking about. He is all wrong. Some men think that because they have achieved a high degree of learning in some field, they are qualified to express opinions in all." The notion that religion is a proper field in which one might claim expertise is one that should not go unquestioned. That clergyman presumably would not have deferred to the expertise of a claimed fairyologist on the exact shape and colour of fairy wings. Both he and the bishop thought that Einstein, being theologically untrained, had misunderstood the nature of God. On the contrary, Einstein understood very well what he was denying. An American Roman Catholic lawyer working on behalf of an ecumenical coalition wrote to Einstein, "We deeply regret that you made your statement, in which you ridicule the idea of a personal God. In the past 10 years, nothing has been so calculated to make people think that Hitler had some reason to expel the Jews from Germany as your statement. Conceding your right to free speech, I still say that your statement constitutes you as one of the greatest sources of discord in America. A New York rabbi said, Einstein is unquestionably a great scientist, but his religious views are diametrically opposed to Judaism. But, why not and? The president of a historical society in New Jersey wrote a letter that so damningly exposes the weaknesses of the religious mind, it is worth reading twice. Well, I'll just have to read it once, I'm afraid. We respect your learning, Dr. Einstein, but there is one thing you do not seem to have learned, that God is a spirit and cannot be found through the telescope or microscope, no more than human thought or emotion can be found by analysing the brain. As everyone knows, religion is based on faith, not knowledge. Every thinking person, perhaps, is assailed at times with religious doubt. My own faith has wavered many a time. But I never told anyone of my spiritual aberrations for two reasons. One, I fear that I might, by mere suggestion, disturb and damage the lives and hopes of some fellow being. Two, because I agree with the writer who said, there is a mean streak in anyone who will destroy another's faith. I hope, Dr. Einstein, that you are misquoted and that you will yet say something more pleasing to the vast number of the American people who delight to do you honour. Well, what a devastatingly revealing letter. Every sentence drips with intellectual and moral cowardice. Less abject but more shocking was the letter from the founder of Calvary Tabernacle Association in Oklahoma. Professor Einstein, I believe that every Christian in America will answer you, we will not give up our belief in God and his son Jesus Christ, but we invite you, if you do not believe in the God of the people of this nation, to go back where you came from. I have done everything in my power to be a blessing to Israel, and then you come along and with one statement from your blasphemous tongue do more to hurt the cause of your people than all the efforts of the Christians who love Israel can do to stamp out anti-Semitism in our land. Professor Einstein, every Christian in America will immediately reply to you, take your crazy, fallacious theory of evolution and go back to Germany where you came from, or stop trying to break down the faith of a people who gave you a welcome when you were forced to flee your native land. Let me sum up Einsteinian religion in one more quotation from Einstein himself. To sense that behind anything that can be experienced, there is something that our mind cannot grasp and whose beauty and sublimity reaches us only indirectly and as a feeble reflection, this is religiousness. In this sense, I am religious. In this sense, too, I am religious, with the reservation that cannot grasp does not have to mean forever ungraspable. But I prefer not to call myself religious because it is misleading. It is destructively misleading because for the vast majority of people, religion implies supernatural. Carl Sagan put it well. If by God one means a set of physical laws that govern the universe, then clearly there is such a God. This God is emotionally unsatisfying. It does not make much sense to pray to the law of gravity.
Well, powerful stuff and arguments from Dawkins there, I think you can agree. And it's interesting, before we go into the musical number, that both Dawkins and Hitchens talk about the importance of controlling breeding and the birth rate and population and control of women's bodies. And this is an interesting point because, especially leading into the title and subject matter of the Python song, is that being a father of... only, in inverted commas, one child. I often, when I say, people ask how many children I've got, and I say just the one, and they sort of say, oh, and there's a sort of gap where they expect you to explain why you've only got one child. And I'd just like to take this opportunity, because it's been getting on my nerves for a while, because especially when I was in hospital, people ask this question, and taxi drivers, especially from certain parts of Asia, shall we say, who've got five kids, and are working, have come to Britain and then are working 13-hour days on the taxis. And I sort of feel like saying, well, if you'd only had one child like me, perhaps you'd have a better life. And I would just like to point out, before we get into the song, that the reason we have one child was a decision we took, a positive decision we had to have one child, for financial reasons, for reasons of space, the amount of time we could give the child, for all sorts of reasons. And it's nobody else's business. But as it happens, because we did tests when we couldn't conceive immediately when we did want to have a child, I can tell you that I am fecund. Yes, I was actually contacted, having given my sample in, by Liverpool Fertility Clinic, asking if I'd like to be a sperm donor. And they reckon I could get loads of fertility treatments from just one sample. My sperm was so good. It's down to numbers and mobility, apparently. So I could have populated a whole village had I wanted to. So I've got that off my chest. It doesn't mean to say that I think I'm superior or I'm more of a man from somebody who can't conceive children or fertilise a woman. But as it happens, I am fecund. So we come to the grand finale and ending, as all big productions should do, with a big number. And this is from Monty Python's The Meaning of Life. We're not going to play all of it, partly because of copyright reasons. I don't have permission to use it. And secondly, for timing reasons, because I'm trying to keep this podcast to about 30 minutes. But if I do have any issue with copyright, I shall appeal to Michael Palin himself, because I did an interview with him in Sheffield, his native Sheffield, in which has become in the BBC archive and was in Radio 4's Pick of the Week, no less, and has been repeated several times on a special programme of Michael Palin's radio days on Radio 4 Extra. But he was in Sheffield to launch a new cinema and a locally produced film about a locally famous man, which I won't go into now. But he did say that it was the most interesting interview he'd ever done, quote, because normally I get asked the same questions over and over again and it's really boring. Well, so that was lovely. So I should appeal to him personally if I get any hassle. But here he is. It is from Monty Python's The Meaning of Life. Every sperm is sacred.
We believe, well, let me put it like this.
There are Jews in the world, there are Buddhists, there are Hindus and Mormons, and then there are those that follow Mohammed's, but I've never been one of them. I'm a Roman Catholic, and have been since before I was born. And the one thing they say about Catholics is they'll take you as soon as you're warm. You don't have to be a six-footer. You don't have to have a great brain. You don't have to have any clothes on. You're a Catholic the moment that came. Because every sperm is sacred. Every sperm is great. If a sperm is wasted, God gets quite irate.
Every sperm is sacred. Every sperm is great. If a sperm is wasted, God gets quite irate.
Let the heathen spill theirs on the dusty ground. God shall make them pay for each sperm.
Spill theirs just anywhere, but God loves those who treat their seamen with more care.
Every sperm is sacred. Every sperm is great.
If a sperm is wasted, God gets quite irate.
sometimes you can say more in comedy and in a funny song than you can in loads of literary texts. So hope you enjoyed that, and hope you haven't been offended by today's podcast. I don't expect I've changed anybody's mind if they're a firm believer in whatever religion you might have. But at least we've balanced the books a little bit in terms of the coverage over the last couple of days. There's loads more I wanted to say, but I did want to keep this podcast and future podcasts indeed to a reasonable length. And as ever, I never forget that you have a choice, and I thank you for spending your time with me on this podcast this time. Next time, who knows? Something lighter, something as serious? Just don't know at the moment. That's the exciting world of podcasting, especially when you've got total control over it. Thanks for listening. Take care. Bye for now.